Marriage promises so many wonderful things, like having an intense emotional connection with another person, like being valued, like having someone be very, very loyal to us. If I'm single, how should I look at it? Is it a curse? Is God punishing me? Does God not love me?
Welcome again to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. On today's program, Dr. Jack Crabtree and marriage and family therapist Christine Barber begin to unpack the issue of singleness. For many people, marriage is a wonderful gift. But what about the single person? Can singleness be a gift from God? Is the single person deprived of something only marriage can offer? How should the single person think about his or her situation? Let's listen now to Jack and Christine.
In the past several weeks, we've been talking about marriage. And today we're going to start a series on singleness. We're not sure how many sessions we will have, but let's get going on it, Jack.
Okay.
This week I was talking to a woman who is single. She was describing a whole lot of things that were difficult about being single. Feelings of loneliness, isolation, feeling different than and other than, and especially having a difficult time being a part of the world socially. She said it was much easier, from the outside at least, it looked much easier to be married than to be single. There's a whole lot of things that we need to discuss, both in terms of what it feels like and what the experience is like to be a single person, as well as what is the biblical view of singleness. And let's start there. Jackson's marriage is a lot of work, and sometimes it works out very well, and other times it doesn't. Many times it ends in divorce or a great deal of disillusionment. Imagine a lot of people say, why not just live together? Why not just remain single? Why bother to get married?
Well, there's several ways to answer that. The simple one is that from a biblical point of view, a quasi-marriage, that is living together as if you're married but not really being married, not being legally married but going through all the motions of being married, that sort of quasi-marriage is not really a morally valid option from a biblical point of view. Now, I think it's possible. There probably are couples who live in a non-married state, but they have what you might call a virtual marriage, that they really do have a moral commitment to one another that is the equivalent of a marriage. They really are seeking to be one, and they really are putting one another at the position of their highest loyalty. All those things that we've talked about in marriage could very well be true of their personal kind of existential commitment to one another.
And what is left out is they haven't gone through any kind of marriage ceremony.
Exactly. And so that really what's missing is that it's incomplete, and we can talk about why that's incomplete, but really what's missing is that it's incomplete, not that it's not a marriage relationship. But I strongly suspect, and I'm just going on anecdotal evidence here, but I strongly suspect that there are many, many quasi-marriage relationships that are just that. They are only going through the motions of marriage. They really are not marriages in the profound sense that the Bible is calling upon us. They are lovers and roommates who are organizing their lives around one another rather than people who are committed to one another to become one flesh and to forsake all other relationships for the sake of one another. If they're not doing that, then they're not taking on the task. They're not taking on the challenge of the relationship that we are called upon to take on by the Bible. And therefore, it's not really a morally valid relationship.
So there's some components that are missing often in relationships where people have not gone through the ceremony. We have talked about those in the past, Jack, but my guess is a lot of people may not have listened to those or may need some review here. So can we go back and look at some of those components, just real quickly list them off. One of them is that we have our highest loyalty to our spouse. That means they become
right.
The most important person in our life, and we show that in many, many different ways.
Right. And the other one is that we're committed to become one flesh with them, and we've defined that in terms of so closely connecting with them that we make it a challenge to come to understand and perceive life through their eyes, to respect who they are, the creature that they are, to appreciate it, to delight in it, to enjoy it, as we take on the challenge of really getting to know them from the inside of their soul, if we can. That's becoming one flesh, I think. And There are a lot of marriages that are legal that don't do that, as we've been discussing over the last several weeks.
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking. That's very true.
Right. So it's not an improvement to have a bad marriage without a license over having a bad marriage with a license. So we're not improving anything.
Okay, so the first one we were talking about is make our spouse our highest human loyalty, more than our friends, more than anyone else, more than our family, our parents. The next one you talked about was respecting the other person as someone who I'm going to get to know, to understand, to see them who they are, not to make them the way I want them to be. So, we're not going to control them, we're not going to try and change them, but understand who they are. And I think a third one is that we talked about is I need to behave in a way that communicates my spouse as special. I need to commit myself to him and him or her alone sexually. I need to communicate that they're special in just a whole variety of ways.
Now, as I was suggesting, I think it's possible for people to really take on the task, the responsibility of that kind of relationship, and have not gone to the trouble to get a marriage license. I still think that that's not ultimately a morally valid relationship in the sense that it's incomplete, and I think it's incomplete in this sense. If I'm really making the commitment to become one with my spouse, it's important that I be one not only in my own eyes, not only in our eyes, the eyes of the two people involved, but in the eyes of the larger culture and society. Why would I deny that of the one that I'm committed to? Why would I say to them, as far as I'm concerned, I'm one with you, but I don't want anyone else to think of us as one? There's just something inappropriate about that, certainly something incomplete about that. And it's got huge consequences in terms of the legal ramifications, for example, inheritance, what's going to happen if I die, what's going to happen to my wife and my children or my husband and my children. There are all kinds of legal ramifications that come from the fact that the society has not agreed formally and officially to acknowledge that we are one flesh. That's not because I have never put them on notice that I expect to be seen in that way. So it seems a very curious kind of relationship where the two people would be committed to one another emotionally and spiritually to take on the task of knowing one another and becoming one in that way, and yet to say to the society, but I don't want you to see me that way. There's something very inappropriate about that.
So you're saying socially or culturally it doesn't really work. What about biblically? Does God consider this kind of marriage, so to speak, incomplete?
Yeah, I think so. I don't see how he wouldn't see it as incomplete. In other words, if God were to step into their life and counsel them at that point, I think he would say, you know, why don't you finish this? Why don't you make this what you have promised one another that it would become? Make it real. You know, the kind of cliche that people use is, what difference does a piece of paper make? But that's to completely misdefine what a marriage certificate and a marriage license is. It's not a piece of paper. It's the agreement of our larger legal society, legally organized society, that we are going to view you as one in the view of the law and in the view of the larger society. Now, granted, my community, my society might view us as one, whereas the law doesn't, but the law is a very important part of society with a great deal of consequences that's a big part of what it means for a big part of the society's perception of me. And I have to take that into account. For me to ignore that is to be incredibly naive.
Jack Crabtree teaches at McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College. For years, he has relentlessly pursued truth, for he believes that truth is both knowable and from God. He is also a man dedicated to his family. In fact, you may even have seen him watching his kids score goals at regional soccer tournaments. For Jack, the truth of the gospel is relevant to all of life. His pursuit of understanding God's word has only deepened his appreciation for God's wonderful mercy. Much of the fruit of Jack's studies are available on tape. You can find out more by asking for the McKenzie Study Center tape catalog. Information will be given at the end of the program on how you can contact McKenzie. Christine Barber is a professional marriage and family therapist. Along with Larry, her husband of 20 years, she works with the Caris Foundation, a nonprofit organization committed to bringing healing and renewal to the lives of Christian leaders. Besides her work in counseling, she's an avid gardener. For her, the beauty of the garden speaks of God's character and his involvement in our lives. She sees God as the author of all creation and the source of our salvation. And she also sees that the truth of the gospel provides the only sufficient foundation for her work as a therapist. Now here again are Jack and Christine.
Jack, right before our break, you said it was incredibly naive, I think are the words that you used, to ignore the emphasis our culture has on actually going through a marriage ceremony rather than just being partners or just being related to each other in a way that we're trying to be socially and emotionally and not socially, but emotionally and spiritually one. Why do you say that? Those are really big words.
Why do I say it's naive?
You said incredibly naive.
Well, I am given to overstatement, so maybe it's not incredibly naive. But getting a marriage license, I mean, I don't think there's any magic in a church ceremony or a particular kind of ceremony. The wedding does not have to be a big deal. It just has to put the legal society on notice that we are going to be one for the rest of our lives. Treat us as one, view us as one. And that can be a relatively simple task. So I have to ask myself the question, why would I be unwilling to do that with respect to this person that I'm claiming to be committed to for the rest of my life? Why does it seem like such a huge mountain here to get over, to go down to a justice of the peace or to the courthouse or whatever, pay a nominal amount of money, sign a couple of papers, and put my society on notice that this is my intention and here's how I want you to view me?
You said, why would somebody do that? Probably, if we had 10 people out here that did it, we probably would come up with 10 answers. But there's one that I'm thinking of.
Okay.
And that's that it helps me hedge my bets.
Yeah, exactly. That's the one I would suspect.
Yeah, that. And what I mean by that is, I'm a little bit scared about getting married. I'm not altogether completely positive that I want to do that. And so if I don't get married, then I'm not saying I'm making this huge commitment, and I can feel, for whatever reason, a little bit more comfortable in that position.
Yeah, that's what I suspect without, you know, we'd have to look at each individual case. But that's the thing that makes the most sense to me. It's such a small step relative to the big step of marriage and all that's entailed. I'm taking on so much already. Why this little thing am I not taking on? And the only thing that makes sense to me is because I want a back door. I want to be able to walk away from this and tell myself I haven't walked away from anything. You can't prove nothing. You know, I didn't sign any papers. I don't have a paper trail that this is what I was really promising. Well, if that's the case, then there's the immorality of it. I'm not really owning my own commitment. I'm not really finally making this commitment. What I'm saying is I'm making this commitment until I decide otherwise, which is no commitment at all.
Yeah, that is not a commitment. And so what I have not done then is actually even spiritually and emotionally married this person.
Right.
So it seems like the piece of paper is kind of a statement to myself and to my spouse and to the culture that I really have made this commitment.
And
it isn't just a piece of paper then.
Right. And I think the evidence seems to bear that out. I haven't read journal articles, but in news reports, I've seen repeatedly the statistics about people who maybe live together for 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years, then they get married and are often divorced within a year. I mean, their living together lasted longer than their marriage. Ostensibly, the reason they were living together is to make sure that this was going to work before they finalized it and made it permanent. The minute they made it permanent, the problems started, or at least the problems that they couldn't solve. It's because the paper changed things. This so-called piece of paper that didn't mean anything transformed the whole dynamic of the relationship. And
how do you see that transformation?
Well, I would suspect that what happens is, it's the point that you were making, that that piece of paper is not merely saying something to society, it's also saying something to my partner, to my wife or husband. It's saying to them, I'm serious about this. I'm making an irreversible decision here. Well, once the decision is irreversible, now all of a sudden, we feel a freedom to relax and be myself and not be on display and not be on my best behavior any longer. They have said they love me for who I am and are committed to me for who I am. Now I can really, truly be me. And then the problems start because I'm not perpetually dating them all the time any longer. I'm now being their wife or husband. And now the work starts. Now I have to learn to respect them, love them, understand them, know them for who they really are, not for the image of themselves that they were constantly, perpetually portraying for me. And that is the challenge of marriage. That's a challenge of marriage that doesn't necessarily exist even in living relationship.
And of course, Jack, it's not the challenge that many married people take up either.
Exactly. Yeah.
So just because I have the paper, I haven't necessarily said, I am going to commit myself to loving my spouse in a way that's very difficult for me, in a way that often requires suffering, requires compromise, requires all sorts of things that are difficult for us selfish people to take on. But not having the piece of paper is also an indication that I'm not probably really committing myself to even trying that. So it kind of puts me, I think, one more step behind.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of another reason why marriage, why after a single person's been living with somebody for a while and then they get married may not work. For many, many people, they've been, as children, they were involved in a family where the marriage relationship was just a really horrible thing. They experienced it like it was, perhaps quite abusive in a number of different ways. So their picture, the idea psychologically in their head of marriage is a very bad one. So getting married says, something. I'm doing something bad. I'm doing something that feels abusive or wrong. And so once they make that commitment on, they sign the piece of paper and make that commitment, I am married, it all of a sudden takes on, it transforms into what they relate marriage to be. And so in order then to, what they're having to do in marriage is change that whole idea. And it's really coming face to face with fears, with pictures, with reality, that's been very, very difficult for them. Sometimes people can take that on and say, here's a challenge, I'm going to do it. Other times people don't even know that the challenge exists in them and they just back out because on a psychological, perhaps not even a real conscious level, it is a horrendous thing in their minds to be married. You know what I'm thinking, Jack, is that maybe some people listening today are thinking that we're promoting actually being married, that we're not talking about having sex outside of marriage. We're kind of saying it's okay to have sex outside of marriage by not talking about it directly.
Okay.
And
I hope they don't think that, because that's certainly not, that's not the biblical view. That's not the view that I would ascribe to. We'll be talking at length about sexual ethics in the future, and we'll explore that. But it, from my point of view, sexual intimacy in all of its forms is something that is only appropriate in the context of a marriage relationship, a committed marriage relationship.
And how we're defining a committed marriage relationship today is that it also includes going through some type of legal ceremony, whether it's in a church or just before the justice of the peace, simple or extravagant, that is included in being married.
Yeah, that's a good point. That the what's crucial, as I understand things, is, am I, in the eyes of the particular culture, the particular society, larger society that I'm a part of, am I married in that society's eyes? There is no prescribed way to do that from the Bible's point of view. Every culture may develop their own systems for two people who are single becoming officially and legally one. There's no right or wrong way for a culture to do that. What's critical is that the culture that I live in, I put it on notice in a way that's meaningful to that culture that I'm married.
Okay.
And in our way, it's just the legal reality of a marriage license.
Yeah, thanks for clarifying that. I think that's very, very important. So, Jack, we're talking about, we've just defined what is marriage a little bit better. But in the next few programs, we want to talk about singleness and the different issues that single people need to approach in their lives.
Yeah, some of the things that we'll have to say will only apply to people who are not only not married, but they're also not attached in a relationship with a member of the opposite sex. Some of the things that we have to say would apply to both people who they may have a relationship, a long-term relationship that they're in, but because they're not married, they're not married. And some of the things we have to say will apply to them as well.
Okay. So, Jack, how should we look at singleness? Is it a curse? Am I a super saint if I'm not married?
Yeah, that's interesting you ask the question that way, because throughout the course of human history, attitudes have been all over the map on singleness. There was a time when it was a real virtue and a real privilege to be celibate and to be single. I don't think that's the prevailing view in our culture today. I think the place to start is to recognize that from a biblical point of view, marriage is the natural state for an adult human being. We were made for marriage. We were created to be married. We were created to have that kind of one flesh relationship that we are committed to, that the Bible talks about in Genesis 2. So it is normal, natural, in keeping with the way God has created our psyche to be married. To be single, therefore, is to be outside of what is, in fact, my natural state. It's to be deprived of the fulfillment of desires within me that run deep within me, that are very natural God-given desires.
So desires for connectedness?
Yeah, for that kind of connectedness that you get in marriage. Exactly.
The desire to be very, very valued by another person?
Secure in their respect and in their love and their
devotion.
Their devotion to me, yeah.
Is it natural to want to be cherished?
Absolutely, yeah. And so that's where the sense of it being a curse comes from, is that, I guess another thing we could say about the state of being single is it is a form of deprivation. Something that I could have and could even describe as a kind of need is not being met. A God-given need within me is not being met. God gives me a hunger for food to sustain my life. If I don't have food to eat to sustain my life, I'm being deprived of something that I need. Marriage is not a need on the same level that I need it for my actual survival, but I do need it for the sense of well-being that marriage provides. And if I am not married, then I am lacking that dimension of that sense of well-being that I could have. So there's, in a sense, a desire or a need there that I am not having met. I'm being deprived, therefore.
That doesn't mean that I can't work at having those needs met in some way. Certainly friendships become a very big part of my life at that point. I don't sit back and just say, God's deprived me and woe is me. What I do is I work at developing friendships that can help meet the needs of being valued, of being cherished, of being special, of people really being devoted to my best interest.
Yeah.
Now, it can't make up for being married. That is such a special and unique relationship.
But it can certainly alleviate the pain of the deprivation. I think that's right. But I do think it's important, the point that you made, that it doesn't really ultimately substitute for marriage, because marriage really is a unique relationship. And friendships, as valuable as they are, in some respects, friendships can be, they're different enough. It's an apples and oranges kind of thing enough that, you know, some of the delights and joys of friendship are unique to friendship. And single people can have friendships that give them delight and joy in their life that I may never know as a married person if I don't have the same kinds of friendships that they have. But by the same token, as a married person, there's the potential for joys and delights there that a single person just will not have, because there's a kind of profundity and uniqueness to the marriage relationship that a friendship doesn't really substitute for. But you're absolutely right. Friendship, on the other hand, can certainly alleviate the sense of isolation that I might otherwise have.
And certainly I should pursue friendships as best I can and work at the friendships, work in me some of the things that can't be worked in me,
right.
Because I'm not married. Okay. It can be the classroom that God uses to help me grow up. I don't have a marriage that kind of takes off my rough edges, so I get into committed friendship relationships that help me to do that. I don't think I'm deprived of a lot of growing up because I'm not married. There's some aspects where I'm just not going to have the experience of being married and growing up in that way. But certainly, I get the opportunity to grow up in the context of relationships if I seriously place myself as a single person into friendships that challenge me.
Right, yeah, I think that's right. If I can back up for a second, the reason it's important, though, to realize that ultimately friendship does not substitute for marriage is that we must, as believers, we really need to work at never denying reality. If I'm suffering, I'm suffering. If I'm in pain, I'm in pain. If I'm lonely, I'm lonely. If I'm hungry, I'm hungry. We have a tendency to want to, I suppose, get God off the hook, improve the public image of my faith or whatever, by turning some of my suffering into some kind of virtue or otherwise denying that it's a problem. So one of the things that we do, we talk about the gift of singleness or something. We say, I have the gift of celibacy. I don't really have a desire to be married. I don't really want to be married. So I'm not really being deprived of anything. We can talk about this more later, but I'm not convinced there is any such gift of celibacy in the sense that we become not your average human being who wants to be married. I don't think God ever takes that desire to be married away from people. That's not what the gift of celibacy is. So the person who is single is being called by God to live in a state of deprivation, in one sense. There are certain advantages to singleness as well, but in another way, it's a state of deprivation. And we don't do anybody any favors by saying, no, I'm not being deprived, by denying the reality of what is before me. I need to face into it for what it really is. I would like to be married, but I'm not married. I have a different calling. I have a different lot in life.
I'd like to tell you something about Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a great books college. And what does that mean? Well, one way to answer the question is to say that the focus of Gutenberg is reading and discussing books written by the greatest thinkers of Western civilization. Another way of answering the question is to describe what a typical day looks like for a Gutenberg student. The day begins by delving into the deep and elegant thought of the ancient Greek mathematicians. In front of his peers, and with their help, a student sorts through a carefully crafted proof penned over 2,000 years ago. Following, the students probe into the nature of written language and the study of classical Greek. It is here that he or she builds the tools for clear writing and skilled reading. Next, they learn of the rise of the Roman Empire. And throughout the week, students will hear lectures on Roman politics, art, religion, and philosophy. They will have the opportunity to ask questions during these lectures, gaining insight into the Roman state. They see how the Romans fit into the bigger picture of developing and declining cultures, which have brought us to where we are today. Then the day culminates with a discussion seminar on Virgil's Aeneid. Together, students seek to understand the story, sometimes exasperated and sometimes excited, but always engaged. After classes, informal discussions are carried on while others chat about the day's event. In the relaxed setting, a student spends a few moments getting to know an instructor. If you're interested in this kind of education, an education that focuses on growing in wisdom, listen at the end of the program for information on how you can contact Gutenberg College.
Jack, before the break, you made a very interesting point to me as a counselor. You said that it's never noble. It's never a good thing for us to deny reality. If we're hungry, we need to say we're hungry. If we're deprived of something, we need to say we're deprived of it. If we feel sad, then let's acknowledge that we feel sad. Let's not, in other words, deny the state of our being. A lot of people could argue with that and would argue with that. What they might say is, if I needed it, then God would give it to me. I need to recognize because I don't need it, God, that's why God hasn't given it to me, and I need to not be sad. I need to not experience the deprivation of my singleness. I need to not even acknowledge my hunger if I can't eat, if there's not food there. I need to surrender those things to God. I need to understand that He would give it to me. If I needed it, He didn't give it to me, so I will surrender to God.
Yeah, that's actually a huge topic. It's not the way I read my New Testament. I suppose if I were to point to one single place, it would be Gethsemane. What you see modeled in Gethsemane is Jesus crying out to the Father, you know, if at all possible, let this cup pass from me. In other words, he's fairly dramatically expressing to God, I am not preferring the position that you've got me in. I'm not liking this. This is not fun. And if I had my druthers, I would rather not go to the cross and experience the alienation from you and your forsaking me in the way that I am looking, anticipating here. He doesn't breeze through the crucifixion gracefully, going, you know, whatever God wants for me is just a delight to me. I'm going to have fun through this. He doesn't resign himself to it in the sense of becoming kind of stoic toward it. He's really, you know, it says that he, you know, some people say that he sweat blood. It could be translated that he, it could be the idea is that he was sweating so profusely that sweat was flowing out of him as if it were blood flowing out of a wound. That's the way I tend to interpret it, that he was just really sweating profusely. Well, that's a lot of stress.
He was experiencing his stress.
He was experiencing stress big time.
He was experiencing the coming deprivation of his life and deprivation of feeling good.
Yeah. And my point is, I'm hoping that people agree with me that Jesus was a spiritual man, a man of faith, a man who trusted God better than any of us could ever hope to, and yet that did not eliminate stress from his life. So experiencing the stress of our discomfort, our agony, our anguish, our deprivation, our suffering, our hunger, and the various ways that we experience suffering in this world is not inconsistent with being a man of, or woman of true faith.
Okay, so let me apply it to what we're talking about today. A single person might be thinking or saying right now, well, what good, Jack, does it do me as a single person to recognize that I'm deprived of this great need for connectedness? What do I do, just sit around and moan about that?
Well, no. I mean, there's two ways to answer that. Practically, what should I do? And we should probably address that. But the point that I'm making is that I'm missing out on a lot if I try to turn my deprivation into some kind of badge instead. If I try to somehow stuff the pain, then what I'm going to miss out on is the way in which that suffering can sharpen my wisdom and my faith and my trust and my understanding of reality. It's through suffering. It's through going to God and saying, God, this is killing me. God, this is painful. God, this hurts. Why are you depriving me of this? Why can't you give me a spouse? Why can't I be married like the other people around me? To cry out of that anguish to God and confront the reality of it and come to terms with, who are you anyway, God? And what is life? And what is my existence all about? Why am I here? I thought I was here to be married like everybody else. Why am I here then? I mean, to ask those kinds of questions and kind of work those things out with God is to become a wiser person in the end. But
isn't
I never even face that if I just say, well, the pious thing for me to do is to not care about whether I'm married or not.
Act like it doesn't matter to
me. Act like it doesn't matter.
When in fact it does matter to me, and I'm just covering up the reality that it matters to
right.
me.
Right. Yeah, that's the point I'm making.
So, Jack, is it okay for people to ask such big questions? They're saying, God, who are you? God, who are you that you would take away this need that I have, or that you wouldn't supply this need for me? I think for a lot of people, they're going to be saying, man, that really looks like a lack of faith, and that would not be pleasing to God to ask those kind of big questions. But what we need to do is just accept what God has given me and leave it at that. It's not trusting Him. It's not believing that He has my best at heart.
Well, ultimately, it's critical that we ask those kinds of questions. There's two ways to ask those kinds of questions, though. You can ask those out of as a kind of way of justifying my rebellion against God. That is, I'm not really asking because I want to know the answer to it. I'm asking because I think I've got God over a barrel now. God, I don't trust you. And you know, you want to know why I don't trust you? It's because you don't treat me very well. Let me ask some embarrassing questions about the way that you're treating me. And I think everybody, every intelligent, objective person will recognize then why I'm completely justified in not trusting you. So we can ask those kinds of questions out of really basically a heart of one who doesn't like God, doesn't trust God, doesn't really care for him, and doesn't want to have to bow a knee to him, and I'm just looking for some kind of justification for that.
Kind of a rebellious heart is what I'm hearing.
A rebellious heart, exactly.
Not a questioning heart, because I could ask the same questions with a questioning heart.
Exactly.
But it's coming from a different place is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, it's coming from a place of, God, I do want to know you. I know you're the most important person in the universe. I know that my existence ultimately is rooted in you and your purposes in my life, but it's confusing.
Or it even could be, Jack, I don't know that you're good, but I want to find out.
Right.
I want to understand. I can't see it. There's nothing in my world that lets me know that. I'm completely, as far as I can tell, almost blind to that, but I want to see it. I'm looking for it. That's not rebellion. That's searching. That's openness.
Exactly.
But it's an openness without any glimmer of light. And some people don't have any glimmer of light in their lives. Yeah. They're saying, I'm dead. I'm destined to nothingness. I'm destined to worse than the worst. If there isn't a God, that's good. And so I will look for him and I'll seek him out. Those people may never find him, but they have an openness of their heart. Not a rebellion that says, you're not real and I'm going to prove it. But I hope you're real and I'm going to look for it.
Okay, now, maybe I'm misunderstanding you, but the way you said that, I'm not sure I would agree with that. I think the people who are truly open in the way that I think you're describing them, they will find God. I mean, I think that's the promise.
They will find God. I believe that.
Okay.
But it could be years and years before they see it.
Yeah.
They could work very hard and hit up against many, many walls till ultimately God reveals himself to them in such a way that they can see him. And that often comes, Jack, from people who have been... Here we are back to my counseling background and working with people who have been severely abused. But people who have been severely abused do not see hope. They do not see light. I'm thinking about Corrie Ten Boom, who was a Christian who helped Jews in World War II, and she was ultimately sent to a camp in one of the Jewish concentration camps, or several of them, I think, but Auschwitz was one of them. And she saw hell upon hell, awfulness upon awfulness happened, but she could retain her faith. One of the reasons she could go through such hell is because she had had the love and affection and understanding and light of a family that cared about her. But you take a child who, in essence, their childhood is Auschwitz. They have never had the light that Corrie Ten Boom had to be able to face into life. To find God through an experience of Auschwitz at my very earliest developmental years is just plain a miracle that some people just have to struggle and struggle and struggle to find any kind of light. Those people who ask those big questions, God, are you real? God, are you good? They come from darkness, but they're trying really hard to head toward light.
I think it's important to keep that in perspective, though. It's really a miracle that anyone comes to know God and see God. I mean, even coming from the best and most secure of family backgrounds, our real problem ultimately is not our lack of emotional preparedness. It's the fact that we are innately and inherently rebellious against God. I mean, I haven't read the book, but I saw the movie. Corrie Ten Boom had a sister who didn't have as easy a time of it as I understand.
No. Her sister actually was Corrie's encouragement to keep looking at
right?
and seeing God. Yeah, quite the opposite.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. It was the other way around. Yeah.
But I would agree with you. Definitely, it's just a miracle of God that any of us see light. But some of those who are looking for light, and I think God has us traveling in that direction, have a far more difficult time finding light, finding good, finding God.
Yeah.
In our lives just because of our background. Other of us, like Corrie, could look back on her background and understand what love looked like, especially she had a father that was very loving. She could look back and access that. And emotionally, psychologically, there was an easier journey even in the midst of Auschwitz, to understand that good did exist and have experienced that.
Certainly you have more experience with that than I do, I'll grant you. But I do think it's important to recognize that because it takes a miracle for everybody, it's not hopeless for anybody. Or to put it another way, it's equally hopeless for everybody in the end, ultimately, and it takes a miracle from God to bring us. But because it takes a miracle, God can grant it. No matter how dark and bleak the prospects look, that's no obstacle to God bringing me the light. That I think is the gist of what Jesus is teaching when he says, knock and it will be opened for you, seek and you will find, ask and it will be given. The point that he's making is that really all that's required of me to know God is to want to know God. God will do the rest. But, and ultimately, of course, God gives me the desire to ask or knock or seek as well, but, as far as it's in my purview, all I need to concern myself with is the question, do I want to know God or don't I? Do I think he's important enough to seek him or not? If I decide yes, no obstacle in the world is going to keep God from bringing me the light and bringing me a knowledge of himself.
Not even my big, huge questions.
Exactly.
Questions that you're saying need to be asked. Let's bring this back to singleness. Actually, Jack, before we do that, I want to say something about this program and how we're approaching it. I think it's a great example today. We're talking about singleness today. But we're not only talking about singleness. We're talking about a bigger picture. We're talking about what does the Christian look like? The name of the program is Christianity at Work. This is Christianity at Work and Singleness. But we're trying to look at how does Christianity work out in our lives? What does it look like down the everyday path of our lives? We'll go off on all sorts of different tangents to try and understand that. Rather than give a step-by-step understanding of singleness, we're trying to get a bigger, broader understanding of life and using these different topics to do that.
Yeah, exactly.
So, now back to singleness. How did we get all the way over here? The way we did that is we were talking about singleness. Is it a curse? And we're saying, no, it isn't a curse. But it's not a natural part of life. It isn't a natural state of life. If it's not a natural state, then why didn't God give that to me? And can I even question that? And we're saying, yeah, we can question that. In fact, we need to acknowledge the suffering that singleness is rather than deny it as though it doesn't exist. Just pretend to be pious when the reality is we are suffering. And it is a difficult position that we're in. We ask the question, if I need really to be married, then God will give it to me. Or won't God give it to me was the question. And there is a bigger question here that we haven't addressed yet. And that's, yes, we do have a need in our psychological, emotional person to be married. But we have a bigger need. And the need is to understand who God is and to make a commitment to him in our lives.
And it is not unlike God to deprive us of a temporal need, a need that is relevant in this present age that we live in order that we might come to the wisdom to lay hold of the solution to my greater eternal need. That's very like God to do that in our lives.
And singleness is just one of those ways that
it's only one of the tools that God has to do that.
Let's talk about other ways, because I think that it might be important here. Single people may feel alone. I'm the one that's being deprived and other people are not. And I think the one that I'd like to bring up first is that many, many, many married people are deprived of a spouse that treats them as though they're married.
Mm-hmm.
They don't treat them with any kind of loyalty. They don't cherish them. They don't seek to understand them. In fact, they're controlling them, pushing them, abusing them. It isn't a marriage in the way that God designed. And so it's very much a deprivation. I was talking to a woman recently who said, you know, when I was single for most of my life, I often did seminars and talks about singleness and how difficult it was to experience the loneliness. She said, but what's far more difficult is to be married and to be lonely, because I have this promise of somebody who's going to care about me, and they are not. And I feel so desperate. Before, at least, I had a chance. Now I have this sense that I'm married, I made the commitment, I'll stick with it. But I am so desperately lonely in the context of this relationship.
And, you know, there's some obvious ones if we stop to think about it. God has robbed people of sight. God has robbed people of hearing. God has robbed people of health in any number of ways. They don't have the strength and vigor that is natural for a human being. Any number of infirmities. And, you know, the classic question of humanity is, why have you done this to me, God? Why have you made me poor? Other people have material resources that I don't have. Why, God? It's out there. Why can't I have it?
But let's answer that question real briefly right now. Why does God deprive us of these things, Jack?
Because his whole agenda in this life, here and now, is to use biblical language, make us fit for the kingdom of heaven, to qualify us for the kingdom of heaven, to make us into people who correspond in my heart and mind and attitude to the kind of people who will people the kingdom of heaven. He wants to give us wisdom. He wants to give us understanding. He wants to give us faith. And those are more valuable if we have the perspective to see that my eternal well-being is infinitely more significant than my well-being here and now in this earth. From that perspective, I recognize that faith and understanding and wisdom are infinitely more valuable than even health or safety or comfort or marriage. Exactly.
It though, Jack, takes so many years to get that, to understand that.
Yeah.
I can imagine listening to this program myself as a 20-year-old and saying, you know, I would like to understand that, but you know, I just don't get it. I think intuitively I know that's probably right, but I just don't see it at all. And it took another many, many years for me to understand that.
And in a way, that's the point of suffering, is that I'd go so far as to say, I'm not sure we can understand it until we have suffered in one way or another. And all of us suffer. We don't suffer in the same way, but all of us suffer in some way. God does not have a child that he does not train. And the training is painful. It is sorrowful for a short time.
And going back to singleness, the suffering isn't a curse. The suffering ultimately is a blessing, so we understand what's most important about life.
Yeah, it's part of our training.
To understand who God is.
Yeah.
To be people of faith.
Exactly.
Jack and Christine will return in a moment. Almost 20 years ago, the Mackenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon, was created as a place where people could come and seriously think about their faith. Over the years, Mackenzie has grown in different directions and gone through various changes, but one thing has remained constant, a passionate love of God's Word and the truth it contains. The Mackenzie staff is dedicated to studying and understanding the Bible. Individually, they want to know what the biblical authors meant when they wrote the Bible. They want to peel away layers of false teaching and get to the very heart of the biblical message. And this is not easy. It's hard work. It requires years of dedication and the willingness to believe what the Bible actually says rather than what they might want it to say. These men and women also believe their studies and their teaching are not perfect. They know their understanding is limited, and they may be wrong, but they trust God to give them the eyes to clearly see His truth. They also encourage others to join them in their efforts, to ask them tough questions, to challenge their conclusions, and to take the Bible seriously. More importantly, they desire that all may come to the wonderful saving truth of the gospel. Much of the teaching done at Mackenzie is available on tape and can be ordered from the tape catalog. Papers and the free monthly newsletter, News and Views, are also available. Information about how you can find out more about Mackenzie Study Center and its ministries will be given at the end of today's program. Now, let's return to Jack and Christine.
So we've come to the end of our hour quite quickly. This is the time for us to wrap up as best we can what we've said. We started a series on singleness, and this is the first and probably a number of sessions because we have this big outline in front of us and we barely even started it.
Yeah.
Like I said during the show, we're really trying to help people understand the greater context of the Christian life. And we're using all sorts of subjects as a springboard to understand them. Some people might get a little frustrated with us because here we are talking about singleness and people might have wanted a lot more straightforward answers. Hopefully people will get more than just the nuts and bolts of what singleness is about or what life is about. They'll understand life from a bigger, broader context that we're hoping to offer. We've asked the question today, how should I look at singleness? Is it a curse? Or am I a superstar? We didn't get too far on that. But one thing we did say is that certainly marriage is a very natural state. We have a very strong heart yearning to be valued and respected and cared about, very deeply connected in an emotional and spiritual way by another person. If we're not then married, if we're single, then we're in an unnatural state in the sense that we're not having those very legitimate needs met. On the other hand, we ask the question, is it a curse? No, it's not. Is it a place of deprivation? Yes. We are deprived of having those needs met. Is that because God's disciplining us because we've been bad? No. It's because God has a purpose that He's using our singleness to work out in our lives.
We will in the future go on to say not only is it not a curse, but it's actually a gift as well. We need to explore that. We didn't in this program, but it's actually more than not a curse. It's actually a unique kind of gift that God gives us.
We talked about if we have this need to be married, then wouldn't God meet that need? And shouldn't we just acknowledge that and just go on with our lives and kind of deny the fact that it's a hard thing for us? And our answer is an emphatic no. In fact, God uses the things that we don't have in our lives as tools to help us come to an understanding of who He is. Should we act like it's not important to us? Certainly not. The suffering involved in acknowledging and knowing what's important to us and not having it is actually oftentimes what brings us to a much deeper understanding of who God is. Should we ask big questions? No, not only should we deny it and act as though it doesn't exist, no, but then on the other hand, should we ask these big questions like, God, why aren't you giving this to me? Is that an act of lack of faith? Well, it can be. The same words can be out of a rebellious heart, or they can be out of a heart that doesn't see, but asking God, beseeching God, wanting God to give us light and give us understanding. Will He do that? Emphatically, yes.
With respect to the thing you just said, James writes, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all men generously and without reproach, and it will be given to him. But let him ask in faith, without any doubting, for the one who doubts is like the surf of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. For let not that man expect that he will receive anything from the Lord, being a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. There are those two ways of asking that James is talking about. God is delighted to give us the wisdom that we want, the knowledge of Him, the understanding that we want. But we must not be double-minded. We must not be the kind of people who are not sure whether God is important enough to be interested in. But to the people who have decided in all of their confusion, in all of their ignorance, in all of their inability to know what life is all about, the one thing they do know is that they want the truth about who God is and what He's up to. Those people will receive the wisdom they want.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the Mackenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The Mackenzie Study Center is a non-profit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of Mackenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.